Welcome, everyone, to this month's installment of TOQ Live. James Edwards, along with my good friend and compatriot, Dr. Kevin McDonald. It is September the 12th as we present to you an installment featuring Guillaume de Rocher, who is making his debut appearance on this now very famous YouTube show, having been denounced with so many other high-quality programs by the ADL, yet here we are still. And Kevin, it is great to be with you, my friend, as always.
Yes, as always, James. I'm assuming our technical difficulties are behind us, and it'll be a great show.
Yes, I believe that they are. So a quick word about that to anyone who was wondering. We are a little late getting this month's edition out, but we had to switch over to a new form of broadcasting, and we want to give a big shout-out and a pat on the back to Ken Gibbidin of thedailyken.com. He worked with yours truly and our web administrator for about 4 or 5 hours yesterday, getting us up to speed on the new equipment we needed to produce this show. So if you want to give Ken a nice token of your appreciation, please go to youtube.com/dailyken. That is DAILYKENN. youtube.com/dailyken. There he produces his own YouTube programming and channel. Kevin and I have both been guests on there as well, and we would not be here today if not for him. But with that being said, very quickly, I want to make mention of the fact that the fall 2019 edition of the Occidental Quarterly is now ready to go out to subscribers, and it will be shipped within the next few days. This YouTube show, of course, exists to promote the work of the writers and, of course, the editor, that being Dr. McDonald, who brings to life the pages of a TOQ each and every quarter. And Kevin, I couldn't help but notice, and I noticed this over the weekend when we were together, that this particular issue, before we go to our guest, features exclusively individuals who have appeared right here on the YouTube show TOQ Live. It features articles from you, Dr. McDonald, Andrew Fraser, who was our guest, of course, last month, Ricardo Duquesne, Brent Sanderson, Andrew Joyce, and Roger Devlin. So each of the contributors to this month's quarterly have been on this show, and they have done a fantastic job, as I'm sure our guest today will as well.
It's a great issue, and I actually had to leave some stuff out. It's 130 pages almost, I think, but we'll have another great issue in the winter as well.
All right. Well, folks, remember, if you want to support the work of Dr. McDonald, the support of Guillaume de Rocher and all of the others who write for the Occidental Quarterly, that is what this channel is here to do. We need your help in order to do it. Go to toqlive.com, toqlive.com/membership, sign up for the journal. But with that being said, Kevin, I know we got a lot to get to. Opening announcements are out of the way. In a little less than an hour, we're going to open up the chat room to those there assembled for questions for you and our guest. But why don't you fire the opening salvo for Guillaume, and tell us what we're going to be talking about today.
Yes, Guillaume is a great writer and has been for Occidental Quarterly for quite a while. He writes on ancient Greece, and I hope he's got a book that should soon be coming out. I would certainly hope so. And he also writes and blogs on European politics, contemporary European politics. He's had a number of articles in Occidental Observer and Occidental Quarterly on the scene in France, for example, and politics in general in Europe. So this should be an exciting conversation.
And for those of you who don't know, Guillaume de Rocher is a European historian with experience in journalism and government. He has written on French nationalism, the European Union, and the biopolitics of ancient Greece. And what we're going to be doing today with him is talking about European politics, the migration crisis, Italy's new government, what's going on over there, and much more, plus, again, your questions. Guillaume, are you with us?
Yes, hello.
All right, well, let's just get started. Where should we begin? Well, there's so much going on in Europe, the good and the bad, but what do you think is most important that should be imparted on our audience? And, in fact, can you remember what you and Kevin started to talk about last week in our maligned attempt?
Absolutely. I think we were talking about Italy, which is probably having the most important developments today, because We have had pretty interesting governments in Eastern Europe, particularly in Poland and especially Hungary, where these are governments which are very loud in their opposition to immigration, and they're trying to increase the birth rate, and that is all to the good. Italy is the first Western European government to move in this direction. They had a populist, nationalist government with the participation of Matteo Salvini, who is the leader of the Northern League. He was the interior minister, and as interior minister, he was able to shut down the migrant crisis in Italy completely. In fact, the previous government, Social Democrats, had started to reduce the illegal landings because it was getting unmanageable even for them. But Salvini really shut it down, and there were a number of very high-profile cases of him arresting a German citizen who was facilitating illegal immigration. He also arrested a communist mayor who was hosting illegal immigrants breaking the law. And this was extremely popular with the Italians. He was winning local election after local election, and he's reached something like 38% support for his party at a national level, which in a multi-party system like Italy is really remarkable. And he was just about ready to hold snap elections where his party would get a very large number of seats, even more than now, and would probably be able to govern with the center-right as the dominant party, or with some even more right-wing elements, namely the Brothers of Italy. I expected this to happen because the populists were collapsing the so-called five-star movement, because they don't have a clear ideology and only had vague economic promises. And they have short-circuited this, however, because the five-stars have allied, who are a populist anti-establishment party, have decided to ally themselves with the Social Democrats, who are the pinnacle of the establishment, and so avoid elections, possibly up to the next 4 years.
That's really disastrous. 4 years. It's a good example of how it's so hard to change things, you know, that the system just has these ways. And if they put off this thing for 4 years, just imagine how much damage that can do. Really a sad commentary on European politics.
Well, and of course, we see it with Brexit as well. I mean, it looks as though now, why even vote? What are we even voting for if they won't even carry out? Of course, we're familiar with that here in America. The rule of the majority almost never carries any of the issues. I mean, how many people voted on any of the latest, most radical egalitarian movements, whether it be homosexual marriage and all of that? It's just ruled by courts and dictated by courts. So we're used to that. But I think Brexit takes it to another level. However, you mentioned this in passing just a moment ago, Guillaume. Not all news from Europe is bad. I'd like to just very quickly share with you something that is quite positive. Russia has done something similar. I don't know when exactly this went into effect in Hungary. I just found out about it recently. But this is an article that I found. Kevin, I'd love to get your response to this as well. Viktor Orban's new pro-family budget, married couples who have the three children will be able to receive 30,600 euros from the Hungarian government. So the deal goes something like this. The offer comes in the form of a 30,600 euro loan to couples upon their marriage. That loan would have to be repaid until the couple has three children. At that point, the debt is forgiven. So in the last month alone, according to this report, 2,400 Hungarian families have already signed up and applied for the loan. In the case that the couple has a child within 5 years, the loan's interest and scheduled payments are both suspended for a period of 3 years. To be eligible for the program, the criteria is that the person must be married for the first time, at least one person of the couple, 180 days worth of tax contributions to the state. The woman must be between 18 and 40 years old. And again, if couples fail to have their first child within 5 years, or they get divorced, they will be required to pay back the loan in full. But upon having the third child, they are able to keep the entire 30,000 euro payment. This is an incredibly sensible solution to, first of all, the declining birth rates, which the left would say requires the influx of third world migrants into our nation states. what's going on in Hungary is very encouraging. Am I missing anything there, Guillaume?
No, you are not. I think it's a good example of what the Hungarians and the Poles are trying to do. And people say, the liberal critics of Orban will say he's just a corrupt, you know, manipulator of the democratic process, that he has made a system for himself whereby the media are loyal to him and there's not really a competitive electoral process. But I simply, and that also that his concern about demographics and immigration is pure political opportunism because the Hungarians have to still be quite nationalistic. But I think this is a good example that his concern about the demographics is legitimate and is sincere, because they're putting a lot of money into this, and money talks. I hope that we, all our countries, start adopting these measures. And I don't remember the exact specifics of the plan, but you mentioned that people have to be working at least 180 days. They have conditioned it in such a way that you have to be a productive member of society to benefit from this loan.
So I wouldn't apply to the gypsies.
Exactly. Yes, it's a huge problem.
Well, this is it. I mean, you're talking about, we live in a country now that squeezes the producers, here in America, I should say, squeezes the producers and rewards the layabouts. Over here, you see something totally different. Kevin, I want you to chime in on this, but listen to what they said, Kevin, and responded to this directly. This is what one of Viktor Orban's spokesmen said. Europe is at a crossroads. Western Europe seeks to address the problem of demography with simple solutions, which only offer short-term success, but convey catastrophic consequences in the long run. The party spokesman continued by saying Hungary has a long-term approach and opts for a more difficult path, as a result of which, however, Europe could become an economically strong, rejuvenated continent. Either we encourage births by placing interests of families in the focus of politics, or we encourage even further flows of migration. This is the ruling party speaking like that.
This is at the same time that you see all these headlines in The Guardian, for example, saying, you know, people shouldn't have children because of the environment, you know, and they always have white babies on the photograph. You know, you see that all the time. At the same time, you know, we need more immigration. And you know, papers like The Guardian are the first to say that. We need more migration from all these peoples, but basically you shouldn't have your own kids. I mean, it's just insane. But, you know, so I'm really glad Hungary's doing this. It's a great step forward. I think $30,000 is a lot for anybody, but imagine for Hungarians, it's even more. I don't think their standard of living is quite up to some other places.
Well, I'd certainly take it. I'm working on number three.
Yeah, it's a lot of money for anybody, I think.
Sure. My wife and I are working on number three with no hope of a $30,000. Stipend forthcoming. Here's something from more central Europe. Philip de Winter, who's I've spent some time with Philip, member of European Parliament out of Belgium. And he, I believe just a few days ago, climbed on top of the roof of Antwerp's City Hall, standing next to a golden eagle, this 500-year-old City Hall building, to denounce what he referred to as the Muslim occupation, or rather the occupation of the city by Islam. So, you know, we've got men of action and we've got men of courage. I think in these dark days, is it the final countdown of Europe, or is it a time when heroes will rise? And it's so encouraging and so enriching to be able to spend time in the company of people like Dr. McDonald, and then, of course, you, Guillaume, today on this live stream. There are people out there that are taking action. It's never as dark as you think it is. I've always been an effusive, glasses half full type of activist, but I think we can turn this around. I think we will turn this around, although America doesn't look good right now.
Well, I totally agree with that. And hey, I was wondering about Hungary. I saw something in the Wall Street Journal that Hungary was actually admitting all these people because, you know, they have a shortage of labor. But I was wondering if they were really immigrants or just contract laborers, because I don't think Hungary wants permanent citizens coming from everywhere.
Well, Kevin, this is where I think we need to be careful about Central Europe. I think Hungary is probably the most ideological of these countries. The populations have an instinctive fear of African and Islamic immigration and a very strong identity. They simply understand that they are a people. They are not Vietnamese. They are not Africans, or they're not gypsies for that matter either. But you see that these countries are, you know, run by conservative guys who want to make money. They're conservative, but they also want to make money. And you do see in Poland and in Romania and possibly in Hungary, I've not heard of this, but it's quite possible, they bring in these guest workers, Vietnamese, whatever, because all the workers have gone to Western Europe. You know, half the, you know, 20% of the Romanian or the Polish, maybe 10% of the Hungarian population have gone to Western Europe, and they have a labor shortage. And so they, you know, they bring in people.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, it's fine to have contract labor, temporary work. You go, you work, and you go back after a certain amount of time. That's fine. It doesn't really change the demographics of the country in any permanent way. But if you mention that to the left in this country and elsewhere in Western Europe, they'll just go crazy. They want these people to be citizens. That's the whole point. And at the same time, they say, yeah, this is not about replacement. This is not about
change. Yeah, it's a conspiracy theory.
It's ridiculous.
Well, it's quite interesting because, I mean, I know quite a few people who, you know, are global jet set type folks who work in Singapore or might work in Dubai and work in all these global cities. And often these places are quite authoritarian. I mean, Singapore is essentially a one-party dictatorship, a very competently run one at that. And Dubai is a, or UAE is a set of, you know, monarchic, autocratic monarchies. And in UAE, it is impossible for any immigrant to get citizenship. The majority of the population is foreigners because they are foreign workers, European or especially Indian and this sort of thing. But they've just decided, we will not ever let you get citizenship. And so the natives are fine.
Yeah, that's a perfect solution. That's what it was going that when I was a kid, you know, I'm from Wisconsin, and they'd have these migrant workers. They come and they pick crops in the summer, and then they go back to Mexico or somewhere else. They never lived, you know, in Wisconsin. They never became citizens. They were just obviously just migrant workers. Then they went back to Mexico in the winter. So that's a fine solution. But of course, that's not what they want in this country. They want citizens. They want voters. They want to import this new electorate, and they've been very successful in doing that.
But there's definitely been a radicalization where even the idea of border enforcement of walls has become offensive to a large part of the left. And you see this with, say, Bill Clinton's speeches in the 90s, where he was talking about border enforcement, and where now this is like Trumpian rhetoric today.
Yeah.
And I think
Obama's talked that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a big problem because in Europe, the tear jerking images, and I think we should talk about this at some point, maybe now, maybe in a bit, that women's empathy for this has gotten out of control.
Yeah.
And that is what has happened, that we have gotten softer. Lifestyle has become much easier. That before, I make this comparison, before, you know, 80 or 90% of the population worked on farms and factories, and women were often happy that they didn't have to deal with the hardship of that kind of work and could stay in the household and take care of the kids, which is kind of a nice activity. And now we're all, you know, office workers, basically, or some form of parasites. And so we don't have a tough daily existence where we have any kind of mettle to assert ourselves, any kind of legitimacy.
It's really sad because they're appealing to these sort of basic niceness of Europeans, and which is why it's more common among women to really be affected by these images. They're the ones who will go out and adopt a baby when they see an image like that. But they're really taking advantage of people's niceness. That and Europeans, I think, are on the high end of that, where they tend to value that, and they want to be liked and loved even.
And they want to be a good person.
Pardon?
They want to be a good person.
And that's right. They do want that. And what, so the establishment, the media and the academic world have created this environment, this moral community, where that's what you have to be. And if you don't show sympathy and empathy for these migrants, then you're a bad person. You're a racist and all that. And so that's where it's gone to. And I'm just wondering if the Republicans they're going to take advantage of this, that because you have the Democrat candidates who don't want to enforce border law at all. They want to make it not a crime to walk over the border, kind of thing. How can you run on that? I just don't think that's the majority opinion in this country yet. I hope not. God, if it is.
The metropolitan elites are really out of touch.
I was just going to touch on this. Y'all touched on this. Let me just expound briefly. This is something that we've said before. Of course, this isn't a new observation, but you're talking about the desires of whites to be liked and accepted. I think that is something that troubles our people in the West more than any other race of people, and even more than whites in the Eastern Europe. But it is true that all of humanity needs some basic essentials in order to survive. They need food, water, and shelter. Well, it seems as though whites in America and in Western Europe need food, water, shelter, and that social acceptance. They want to be pat on the head by their oppressors, even. They want to be good. They want to be philanthropic. They want to be all of these things. But I think another thing, and I made mention of this over the weekend, Kevin, at that joint speaking engagement that you and I appeared at, is that our people haven't suffered enough in the West. And to the extent that America still has a moral compass and a section of the country that has a cohesive identity, even though it's much watered down now compared to what it once was, is, of course, in the South. Now, the South and Eastern Europe has a little bit of something in common, and that is that they have suffered. The Eastern Europeans suffered far worse and for far longer under the horrors of Bolshevism and the menace of communism than the South did during our war against the North and then the subsequent Reconstruction. But we did suffer, and that suffering brought us together. And the suffering that the Eastern Europeans did brought them together. They banded together and they formed an identity and a distinct and separate culture. So perhaps Western Europe needs to suffer more, and perhaps that is what will come. I mean, I don't know the exact cliche or it's, you know, good times make soft men and hard men make good times, and there's something of that to that effect, but that is something that we will have to address. But going back, Guillaume and Kevin, are there, I know one of the things y'all were going to touch on last go around was some matters of European antiquity. Are there any parallels we can go back to that would help advise us of the troubled waters upon which we're entering? I mean, can you go back to even the Muslim occupation of Spain? I know that the enemy has far greater weapons now in terms of the media and other things that they didn't have back then. But are there any parallels we can look back on and say, you know what, if they can overcome that, we can overcome this?
Well, I do think there are parallels in the past that, as you say, the media was not as important then, but there was media, you know, especially for people who were sort of the higher end and more educated people. They would read books and so on. I recall one of my books, The Separation of Discontents, I talked about the culture is from the Spanish Inquisition. And at that time, these crypto Jews were, as they are now, they were very much involved in creating a sort of a culture, media culture, that was very favorable to them. But that came out in books and pamphlets and other, you know, printed media at the time. So it's got a long history. I don't know in the Greek world how that would work, but they, you know, it's certainly something that every movement has taken advantage of, whatever the current media is. I had a section in my book coming out on the anti-slavery movement. The Quakers and the other anti-slavery activists were very big in the media. They would write these op-eds all over the place and plant them and really try to get a culture where slavery was disapproved. And they were quite successful at that. I mean, it was overwhelmingly successful. By the end of the 18th century, it was in place.
Yes. I will take up your question, James. I have I want to go back to Italy just to have a positive note, which is because we shouldn't be unduly negative. On the one hand, the nationalists will be out of the government and you'll have this social democratic, vague populist coalition. The fact is, Italy has done very poorly economically pretty much for the last 15 years, and they have a huge amount of public debt. They are part of the Eurozone, which is a currency union, which is a very bad fit for them. They've made them lost competitiveness, and they can no longer refinance their debt through their central bank. And so it means that they have to pay punitive interest rates on international financial markets. Ezra Pound would be rolling over in his grave. But it means that the populists and the socialists will have to deal with that. They're going to have to probably pass some either difficult reforms or they're going to just face permanent stagnation. And I hear, I don't know, I'm not an economic forecaster, but I hear a recession will come in a year or two. It certainly has been 10 years since the last recession. And if so, that means they could get all the flack for economic problems. And that could open the way for the nationalists. I want to keep hope because actually I don't think they are out of the woods at all. I think these kind of cobbled together globalist led government sort of without an election, without people having approval, they don't really work in general. They tend to fall pretty quickly. And we can go back to Hungary where they precisely, the Orbán came to power when the socialists of that country had a huge financial scandal and admitted in private, it was tapped of lying about the finances of the pension system in that country. And that led to a total collapse of the left and the rise of Orban, who then radicalized. So let's not take short-term news too negatively. I think we have to keep an open mind. Good things can happen.
But yeah, I mean, it just goes back to what we touched on a second ago. If you would have thought in the 1940s or the 1950s, and even beyond that, that Eastern Europe, which was under the grip of communism, would be perhaps the key to white survival in the year 2019, it would have been perhaps unimaginable. That they would be leading a nationalist, traditionalist renaissance.
It could be. Very true.
So anyway, very quickly, in 30 minutes time, ladies and gentlemen, those of you tuned in live, viewing live in the chat room, we're going to open the chat room floor for questions from the audience to our guest this month, Guillaume DeRocher, and of course, Dr. McDonald. So in 30 minutes time, we will do that. And again, please be sure to bookmark toqlive.com. There you can subscribe to the journal and help keep the work of these fantastic academics current and forthcoming. But Kevin, back over to you.
Well, maybe we should get on to some other topics. I've been very excited to publish a lot of things about Guillaume's work on ancient Greece. Because it's very interesting. I mean, the Greeks were more ethnocentric, I'd have to say, than other Western peoples historically. They were, and Sparta was really an ethno-state. All these little city-states seemed to be very particular. Isn't that right, Guillaume?
Absolutely. I have been investigating Western classics, sort of the high points of our civilization, and we can think of the Greeks, the Romans, the Middle Ages, and the modernity with the Enlightenment. And of all those, the Greeks have resonated the most with me. because they are very practical in their politics. Their politics is, can we have a space for our people? And how do you do that? You have a band of men acting as soldiers, conquering a space. When they sent out to create a colony, the colony was essentially an army. And the colony was wherever that army could secure a space and fend off invaders. And if you did not succeed as a community, you fell and were wiped out as a community. Maybe you were wiped out by other Greeks. Maybe you were wiped out by some local tribe or the Persians or the Phoenicians, whatever it was, you were all in this together. And so the Greek conception of freedom is a communitarian one. This is something I am really stressing a lot. I have completely lost sympathy with the modern notion of unlimited individual rights. It just, people cannot rationally justify, why should you have gay marriage? Why should you have equality between this group and that group? There's no basis for it, except we are all individuals and therefore we should be equal and we should all have the same choices as an end in itself. That's my issue. They say this kind of freedom of choice and fictitious equality between individuals is an end in itself. And people get extremely moralistic about it. But the Greeks had a different conception. They said the rights of the different citizens, the citizens have rights, but they are according to what is good for the community. And so what is good for the community is where men and women have children, which perpetuate the community. The Greeks are extremely biopolitical. This is extremely striking. It is fairly rare. I've not seen any other European civilization get to this point of biopolitical consciousness as the Greeks. So you need to have children together, and men need to be as strong, as excellent, as free as they can be in order to make a great accomplishment, but also to make the community survive and thrive.
Right, and as you really emphasized a number of times, is that it was a cruel world where, you know, if you got conquered, it was really the end. You'd be slaughtered, enslaved. You had some very stark choices to make. And so you had to really have a community feeling. You couldn't fool around with the gay rights or something like that just to make a small number of people happier. You had to, you know, focus on the family. You had to focus on creating fighting men. I mean, you think about Spartan civilization where it was completely militarized. It was just a different, you know, whole ethos where you feel constantly under siege. And that was the world they lived in, and they survived for a long time. They did very well until I guess the Romans finally did them in for good. But they still were the Greeks.
I would definitely connect this with the excellent work of our colleague Ricardo Duchesne, yes, on the Indo-Europeans, who are traditionally called Aryans, who now are sometimes called Yamnaya. These are a central European, basically European, sorry, people based in the Pontic steppe around Ukraine and the Caucasus. Basically European, they ride horses. They look like Conan the Barbarian. And they expanded from this area to conquer a huge landmass. They expanded into Europe, into Persia, and into India, essentially founding three great centers of civilization. And the Greek conception of liberty and of the Republic owes an enormous amount to the Indo-Europeans. The Indo-Europeans were a patriarchal, sky-worshipping people. They had chariots. They had warlords. It was a warlord culture. And their aristocratic notion of freedom, that it wasn't just one despot it was at the top. It was a group of excellent men. Driven by a competitive spirit, driven by the desire for prestige, the desire for dominance. This is the foundation of the Greek city-state, of the polis. Without strong men, there is no republic. You just have I don't know, parasitism. You have something which in any traditional setting would not be sustainable. And in a modern setting is basically parasitism.
Well, one thing that the Greeks said, I believe it was a Greek maxim, and it's an eternally wise maxim. It went something along the lines of all things in moderation, nothing in excess. And by that, I interpret its meaning, even a virtue, when carried to some illogical extreme, can be damaging. For instance, our altruism, when carried to this illogical extreme to where we can only be good if we are giving our abilities and talents and resources to the other, then that is something that you've taken a good and turned it into a bad. Roger Devlin recently wrote, you were talking about freedom and equality, and he wrote an article for VDare.com, which talked about how our discourse has just regressed to the point where now it's just everything is basically sound bites using God words and devil words. And by devil words, he illustrated as being white supremacists and racists. And that's just what you call people that with whom you disagree. And of course, that the God words are equality and freedom. And how dare you be against the egalitarian march of equality and freedom? Well, of course, we're free to do things today in this country that we weren't free to do when we were born. But are we better off for it? Are we going to be better off when the day comes? And who's to say that it won't? If you take the logical progression, it most certainly will, when pedophiles are able to marry children. Is when we reach that level of freedom, are we going to be better off or worse off? So I kind of like going back to the lifestyle our ancestors had, where we built strong men, we fought for what was worthy of being fought for, and we left the rest of it to on the table. And make no mistake about it, and we said this too this weekend, Kevin, over the weekend, if the wrongs are going to be righted, we need to get off from blaming the other for all of our ills, and we need to focus inward. It will be white men who must deliver us. Only white men can get us out of the mess that we're in. And unless strong white men, like those Greeks, like our ancestors in some of these nations from whence we came, unless we rise up as men, it's just not going to happen. So it rises or falls with us and us alone, I see.
Yeah, and I that's a good point about this week when we were in the South, and you see that culture much more. It's interesting to me to see it up close and personal. Some of the personalities there. I mean, these guys all grew up with guns. They have a sort of military culture, and most of them served in the military. Although a lot of them, are completely disillusioned about where the military is serving in the last two or three decades, where we have these hopeless, ridiculous wars, really going back to Vietnam. That's the kind of men we need. And I just hope there's enough of them left. You know, there's so many men now are just pacified in one way or another. They've become more effeminate. They don't value courage or honor. They don't value, taking risks. Men, for a man, taking risks is a big part of masculinity. You have to go out there. You have to take some chances. You have to, assert yourself, and because the evolutionary problem for men has always been, how do you make it? How do you rise in the dominance hierarchy? How do you get resources and access to mates and everything? Because it's always been very competitive. But that's what we're losing big time, because this whole feminist culture. Yeah, we talk about constantly toxic masculinity. That's the big one of the big words now. Toxic masculinity.
Yeah, and you've gotta have that masculinity. That was the way of Western man. I want to go back to you. As you can tell, I've got a little bit of a head cold. I exited a moment ago to get some water. It's I feel pretty cloudy, and perhaps not all my wits about me. But this was so. I want to turn a lot of time over to y'all. Before in 15 minutes time when we open up the chat room to questions. But no, the point was, Kevin, that you were making, that used to be the way of Western man to sail beyond the known horizon, to scale the highest summit. Yeah. That was something that burned within us, that desire to conquer. Mm-hmm. And now It's the desire to apologize. And you can never apologize enough to Curry Fink.
Christopher Columbus took a big risk, even though where he was going. And so, he did.
Big risk. No, I think we have had in the last 70 years a huge feminization of society and culture. And this is, in the mainstream of society, considered a big success. We should point out that one of the things I think is so attractive about the Greeks is that they were both a gifted people and they had barbarism. They had a barbaric side to them. They did not, you know, reciprocity and treating people as your equals is very nice. It can calm things down. It can make things, it can make life more livable, easier, and all this. But they didn't have time for that because they had such a tough existence. They had slavery. They had the risk of conquest, as Kevin McDonald said. And so they told the truth no matter if it offended anyone. They didn't care because they had that aristocratic mindset. They said, if this man is excellent, he is excellent. If this work is excellent, it is excellent. And if this person or this statement is worthless, then they will also say that. And this has been completely lost because of the feminization of culture. Men are defined by conquest and competitiveness. Women are defined by nurturing and consensus. I saw this nice video showing people at the gym. The men were all working out by themselves on the machines, you know, each with their personal program, trying to show off. And the women were all in the yoga class or the, you know, the group lesson, right? And that's how it is. The women like to be together doing the thing, and the men like to be on their own or maybe as a small team, you know, in a competitive, not a consensual mindset. And you know, the testosterone levels have collapsed since the Second World War. This is a reality. Yeah. And I'm sorry to say that, you know, there are people trying to reverse this, and we should, you know, you should work out. You should go out there. You should be a man. In fact, it is easier to be a man to the extent that you're surrounded by wimps, right? You shine by just making a bit of effort. But I'm afraid that we are going to have to live with this situation. It's not going to change because of the change of lifestyle. And so we're going to have to find creative solutions. I don't know what it will be, but this is not going to go away.
Yeah, God forbid we become a culture defined by nurturance. As you say, women are defined by nurturance. You know, if we become a culture defined by nurturance, I think that's where it's headed. You know, I mean, where... you know, any kind of immigrant or any kind of migrant, a poor person anywhere, you have to nurture them. And not only send them foreign aid, you have to let them live in your country, put them on welfare, whatever. That's where it's...
This is how I see what has happened. There are an infinity of aspects. There are so many ways of looking at the situation. To me, the fundamental way of seeing it is psychological, which is that, and for a large part, it is women now see everyone as their symbolic children.
Yeah.
And so if you are tough on, you know, you criticize, you know, you don't criticize little Timmy. You don't say little Timmy is an idiot, even if he is an idiot. You know, because to them, this is undermining his self-esteem and he's not going to be able to thrive. And that makes sense in the woman's world of making sure that all the children are able to have some self-esteem and be able to operate. But in the man's world of actual fighting with others and making sure we have our space and, you know, able to survive, this is crazy. But women now see all the third world people as their children. And you notice that married women tend to be a lot more sensible than married women with children tend to be a lot more sensible than single women. Single women are a disaster. Single women, first of all, there shouldn't be so many people at university, period. But single women in university or, you know, working yuppie jobs in these government make-work schemes into their 30s is a biological disaster. And we're going to pay a price for it.
we're paying it. We're paying it. And you just touched on so much truth. I heard more truth in the last 2 minutes than I have.
It really reminds me of the whole safe spaces idea, you know, where you have these colleges, they have actual physical places where you can go and feel safe. And you should never have to have anybody say anything in your presence that offends you. I mean, it's ridiculous, which would mean, you know, you can't talk about race differences in IQ. That might offend somebody. You can't talk about, you know, that you like Donald Trump. That certainly is going to offend a lot of people. Much less, you know, the people on the right. And, you know, that's the way it is. People have to go through life with never having any unhappiness or discomfort of any kind. It's amazing. That's not the world we evolved in, believe me.
Well, we need tougher men. We need tougher men. It's been mentioned. It should be mentioned again. It should be mentioned over and over. Only our men will be able to lead us out of this morass. Now, in 10 minutes, we're going to open up the chat room. Lots of questions for Dr. McDonald and our special guest this month, Guillaume DeRocher. And what a fantastic conversation. What a fast-paced and fast-moving conversation. It's been hard to believe we're nearly an hour into it. Gentlemen, with about 10 minutes left before anything goes in the chat room, what are some final thoughts that should be a part of the
podcast? One thing I should bring up is that Guillaume just wrote a great article about Frederick the Great and his interactions with the Jewish community in the 18th century. This is very very interesting. But perhaps you'd want to talk a little bit about that.
For sure. So Frederick the Great was the king of Prussia in the 18th century. Prussia was a large German kingdom. A lot like Sparta, militaristic, austere, and with a very small territory, was able to become a great power and eventually to unite Germany. Prussia has always been an inspiration for me, and I think the destruction of Prussia in the Second World War was a great loss. Frederick the Great had a Jewish policy. He had a small population of Jews in his country, and he had a very explicit approach. He was not motivated by Christian anti-Semitism because he was not particularly Christian. He was an Enlightenment philosopher king. He didn't think that religion was very serious. He thought it was superstition. And so he was pretty tolerant of all religions. He was not motivated either by the later racial anti-Semitism, because this was not yet a widespread theory of how things are. And so he, in principle, was very favorable to the Jews. But he found that in his practical experience, that the Jewish population caused a lot of problems in his kingdom. They would be extremely nepotistic and would take over certain trades and exclude Christian traders. They would engage, according to him, in a huge amount of fraud. And this was a daily problem with Jews coming into the country, coming out and engaging in fraud and tricking the natives. And they would outgrow their economic niche. So they would come into the kingdom, and while his kingdom could support maybe, 1% of a population of Jews, they would come in and there'd be too many of them. And so he decided, for the sake of his kingdom, that they had to be less of them, and that he would maintain the status quo. He had a moderate policy where their number should not increase, but could just stay as it was, and you need a permit if you came in. So that was his policy. But you saw that it got undermined over time, partly because he found the Jews useful to him economically, because they would do certain industries and he could tax them, or they could do things like money minting or financial schemes. And in fact, his relationship with the French philosopher Voltaire was ruined because Voltaire got involved in some dubious financial schemes with a Jew involving like trading bonds, just obscure stuff. And Voltaire then left. And after he passed on, the Jews had more economic clout and were able to influence the court more and more to remove the limits on their action that that Frederick had instituted. And so gradually they got emancipated. They were treated as individuals, even though they acted often as a group. And this led to a situation that we know in Germany that eventually led to the Third Reich and all that.
Right. Very interesting story. And it, you know, one thing that strikes me is that it's sort of happened in other places. I mean, in fact, throughout Eastern Europe, basically Jews overran their economic niche, and they became, their economic niche was as, you know, tax farmers, estate managers, saloon owners, petty traders of all kinds.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But then in the 19th century, they just say there's so many of them. They were highly fertile. They had a lot of children. And eventually the whole community ended up, most of the community ended up being quite poor and wanting to emigrate. And this was then they ended up emigrating to the United States and Western Europe, creating other issues. But they've been a difficult population to handle. Even someone as enlightened and as sort of, he wasn't an evil man by any means, Frederick the Great, and he wanted the best for his community, and that's that communitarian viewpoint, which is anathema, you know, to our elites now, and that is really problematic. I think we don't have more of it.
And Frederick was classically trained. He knew classical philosophy. He also knew his Bible, although he didn't like it very much.
He was a composer too, right?
Yeah, he played flute. He wrote books. I mean, he was really, to me, I think it's interesting to study these people who embody the best of the autocratic tradition in Western civilization, because there's the Republican tradition, which is very good and very and is unique essentially to us. So I absolutely value the Republican tradition of the Greek polis, of the Roman Republic. But the fact of the matter is, people who define Western identity by Republican values are omitting half of Western history, which is not Republican values. It's the Roman Empire, it's chivalry, it's monarchy, and they did a lot of good. Europe thrived in the Middle Ages, actually. It set the stage for our global domination. And so Frederick the Great was a great king.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, that we haven't always had these values, and yet we have prospered in different eras without them. A very good point to make. And yeah, I would stress, you know, that at other times aristocracy has been responsible towards the people. I think of Louis the Ninth, of St. Louis in France. You know, he had a very strong community sense and wanted to do the best for his people. He was not an exploiter. He was not a parasite. He actually lived like a monk at a time when he was probably the wealthiest person in Europe. So that there is a tradition of that, and we should keep that in mind. And unfortunately, so many of the aristocrats were not that way, and we many, many examples were, and again, it intersects with Jewish issues, because quite often these aristocrats would make alliances with Jews and basically give them carte blanche. They could lend money, they could levy taxes, and that sort of thing, and that then would produce incredible animosity with the people, and eventually be a big clamor and uproar, and oftentimes Jews ended up being expelled. For example, from England, I believe in 1216, and it was for those very reasons because there was the indebtedness and the fact that Jews were really an exploitative element in the population, widely resented from the highest level. I mean,
we really have to say that traditional Jewish religion is essentially a supremacist religion where all non-Jews are devalued as such on a racial basis. And it says that you should always put Jews first. And if you don't, you know, if you help them, it's only because you don't want to be to bring opprobrium upon the Jews. That's the only reason you might help a Gentile. So that was the situation in Orthodox Jewish communities, and it's still the situation today in Orthodox Jewish communities. But that was the norm. You didn't have secular Jews claiming to be for universal morality, etc. They really were for in it for themselves, and Christians resented that.
Yeah, I mean, and that's something that if you go to Wikipedia and look at online about Jewish ethics, just plug that into a search. You go to Wikipedia or someplace, and they'll talk about Jewish ethics as if it is this universalistic thing. It was never that way. It isn't that way. It's very particularistic. It's about their people, their interests. And I mean, if you look at Jewish writings from the Old Testament on, that is the clear, resounding drumbeat of a message that we have interests in, and as a people, very communitarian. And you know, you so often are the aristocrats and other elites in the West have made alliances with these people against other segments of the population. And of course, we really see that now. You know, when you see the working class, especially the white working class, being left out, really what their interests are not being taken care of at all. And there's an unholy alliance between business interests and ethnic lobbies to displace those people. And but it's been going on a long time. It's a recurrent theme. But again, there are good aristocrats. Someone like Frederick the Great should be a model of what an aristocrat could and should have been.
All right, gentlemen, we have to push pause on the conversation right there because we are going to open up the chat room for questions to both Dr. McDonald and our featured guest, guest this month on TOQ Live, Guillaume DeRocher. But allow me to once again make mention of the fact that this YouTube series exists to promote the work of the Occidental Quarterly Print Journal. The fall 2019 edition here in my hands, about to be mailed out to subscribers, featuring articles from none other than the incomparable Dr. McDonald, as well as Andrew Frazier, Ricardo Duchesne, Brent Sanderson, Andrew Joyce, and Roger Devlin, all of whom have appeared on this very YouTube show. So if you want to be a part of the coalition that are keeping the work of these academics on the front lines, you need to become a subscriber to the journal, to which our guest, Guillaume, also contributes. TOQlive.com, folks, we need you to go there. If we didn't need it, we wouldn't ask for it. TOQlive.com/membership, subscribe to the journal. Now, we have been deplatformed by everyone under the sun. So, when you go to toqlive.com/membership, you will trigger an invoice, you'll print it out, you'll mail it in with a check, just like your grandparents used to do. I promise you can still do that, and you will be among those keeping this fine journal now 2 decades into its run. This is the 19th volume. You'll keep it alive, and we need you to keep it alive. So go to toqlive.com/membership and subscribe today. Now, for the next
subscriptions are not expensive. $60 for the hard copy version, $30 for online. This is not going to break anybody's bank, okay? And it's a nice gesture that would keep something going. I mean, there's so many writers where the Occidental Quarterly really is the only outlet for what they can do. They can't send this stuff to academic journals anymore. And even though it's academic quality, in the same world, they'd be publishing in, you know, top academic journals. But it's not a same world anymore. We have to have outlets for these people. So this is a very important thing to do.
I'm sure Dr. McDonald could think of other things to do in his retirement, but because he loves his people and he loves these ideas so much, he's continuing to put in the time. He's out in the vineyards every day toiling away. So come help us, won't you? All right, let's take it to questions, gentlemen. And we've got some good ones lining up. And as always, we never have enough time to get to them all. But let's first take this one from a young mother who writes, "Women cannot raise men by themselves. I can barely keep my boys in line, and they have a great dad. So here's the question. Your thoughts on watching TV and the sedentary lifestyle leading to apathy towards our people. Research suggests that men who watch more than 20 hours of television per week had a sperm count 44% lower than those who watch the least. So I think the question might be, how do we go about bringing forth strong men again who will raise subsequent generations of strong men?
Well, I agree with the questioner a sedentary lifestyle, watching television, this is something that is poisonous. And it's probably been increasing throughout the 20th century, but certainly in the last few decades, I was fortunate. I didn't even have a television in my home until I was in 13 years old or something like that. People played and read books. I used to read books all the time, and that was what you did. Well, nobody reads books anymore, and that's a big problem. But getting out and playing, getting exercise is very important at all ages. Competitive sports, you talk about, molding men. Well, a lot of masculinity is molded on the playing fields, football, baseball, basketball. You still see a very masculine culture in those sports.
Guillaume, up to you. And I would just quickly go over the guidelines here. With so many questions coming in, we'll try to keep our answers to 30 seconds, a minute apiece, so we can work in as many as we can. Questions coming in for both of you pretty rapidly. But Guillaume, this is a provocative question. So your response, your thoughts on watching TV and the sedentary lifestyle, does that lead to apathy towards our people and amongst our people?
I think watching TV shows can be good insofar as it's a quality show, which sometimes happens. I hear Breaking Bad is good. I thought the three first seasons of Game of Thrones were good. It gives you a connection with other people. We cannot be disconnected from others. This is a big problem. We cannot be too isolated. But I know quite a few people who are binge watchers. All these TV shows, it takes 20 or 30 hours to watch one single season. Who has time for that? I don't have time for that. You shouldn't have time for that. You should be doing productive things. So Netflix binge watchers, you should feel terrible and you should stop doing it. Most of the shows are not very interesting, very good. You should get better taste, read some books. I'm sorry.
Or put it this way, if you're doing that, that's time not being spent on doing something more productive, and we can all think of more productive
things. You should get a life. Not living it.
Well, this is something that, we would certainly want to make a point to ask toward the end of the show, but let's go ahead and work it in now to be sure we get to it. This question for you, Guillaume, where can people learn more about your work? The questioner writes, I would like to learn more about your focus and the areas that you're researching.
Well, that's a flattering question. You can find my Twitter account, Guy Durocher, G-U-I Durocher. And you'll find me there, and I tweet all my work and on my other thoughts. I'm available at Countercurrents, at the Occidental Observer, at Radix. If you go in the Radix archives, you'll find me there. Even though that journal of Richard Spencer has been more or less shut down. And now I write a weekly column for the UNS Review. The UNS Review is a great publication, a free speech publication, published by a righteous Jew, Ron Unz, who apparently believes in free speech and I don't know, fair play. I don't know. He's publishing great stuff on the Second World War, on Jewish influence, on race, on everything. He's very good. So you can check me out there.
Okay, fantastic.
I would say about Ron Unz, his site is now rated very highly. He's ahead of a lot of sort of mainstream news sites now in terms of his traffic.
A lot of traffic.
They beat the New Republic.
Right. And he also will repost articles from the Occidental Observer from myself and other Andrew Joyce. All of our writers are on his review because he reposts our material.
All right. We have about 20 minutes left in this session. So we're going to put the pedal to the metal and get to, again, as many of these questions as comments as we can. Some are for you as individuals. Some are to both of you. And this one is to both of you. So we'll start with Guillaume and then go to you, Kevin. Do you think it's desirable for the pro-white crusade to chat up traditionalism? It's fine to discuss the past, but can it be recreated or should it be?
Well, that's a big question. It depends what you mean by traditionalism. We like to make fun of conservatism because conservatism is a kind of nostalgia. And, you know, it's in French politics, for example, they complain about burkinis, which is burqas that Muslims wear at the beach. But really, the problem is that Muslims came here. That's the original cause. So you should get agitated about causes and not effects. Life has changed. Technology has really changed everything. We don't know how things will go, so we really need to be creative and not clinging to the past in that sense. I think I am a traditionalist in the sense that every tradition, Christian, Islamic, Stoic, Buddhist, has been about reconciling human beings to the horror of the world and transcending it. We can't imagine, you know, the women who died in childbirth, all the most people had difficult, stunted lives, but they had to live anyway and thrive as a community. Well, I feel like we are living difficult, stunted lives right now because truth is so shut down on a daily basis that you really, as an intellectual anyway, can't do any useful work in the society. You can only focus on irrelevant nonsense. And so for that, you need to turn inward and you need to have a spiritual self-discipline. Hopefully that spiritual self-discipline can create bonds with other people, can create a kind of asceticism where you don't waste resources and you focus on what's most important. That's the idea. It's hard to put in practice.
Kevin.
I think it's very, yeah, sorry, I'm going on.
No, finish it by all means.
No, I say this without blushing. I take a lot of inspiration from Gandhi. He threw away everything he owned and he focused on one thing, which was the independence of India. And he did this on a kind of traditionalist basis. If we had a few Gandhis in Europe and North America, we would be free.
Kevin, you talk about traditionalism and its role in our current cause. You know, I look at 1950s America and I say, that looks pretty good to me. The writing may have been on the wall, but boy, it must have been nice to have lived through it even for a time. You think about the traditional nuclear family, of course, a building block of civilization. Where does traditionalism fit into where we're going as a people, Kevin?
Well, you know, I grew up in the 1950s, and I think it was a golden decade. And it actually was a golden decade if you measure things like divorce rate, birth out of wedlock, and family functioning. Since 1960, I mean, you can date this. I used to teach developmental psychology and child psychology, and every semester, you know, in the textbook, I would highlight these charts showing the rise of divorce, the rise of out of wedlock birth, the rise of single parenting. And it's been going on now for a long time. And Charles Murray, with his book Coming Apart on the White Working Class, has been destroyed. And now the opioid crisis. So we have, you know, there were parts of our culture that were pretty healthy not too long ago, but they have been destroyed. It's the rise of this new elite that really came to power in the 1960s and has really marginalized the working class, marginalized the family. I think, James, you're very fortunate. I think, you know, being in the South, I think they've held on to those values longer than elsewhere in the country. I was talking to someone at the conference over the week with Michael Hill, and he was saying how the South resisted a lot of the countercultural changes of the 1960s. Well, I think that's all to the good, because as long as you can resist that, you're going to be better off. These cultural changes, which were, really voiced, they were part of this elite culture, top-down culture, psychoanalysis, and other influences that have really affected family life. And certainly a big part of that is the LGBTQ plus movement now, whatever plus is. And all that is part of this, where, you have TV shows like Modern Family, which I've never seen, but I think it involves all kinds of people with strange sexual identities and that sort of thing. That's what they want. Back in the 1950s, you had mom, dad, and the kids, and divorce was very low. And kids were brought up in intact families. Well, that's all changed, very sadly. And it's a big problem growing up in a single parent household and not having a man around. You know, you talk about the culture of masculinity. Well, it's not going to be there in a female headed household. It's something that we have lost.
All right. Here is that was a fantastic answer from both of you. Of course, here is another good question. We'll start with Guillaume on this one and then back to you, Kevin. Before I ask the question, I'll just preface this with a comment, which leads into the question. And this is just my personal observation. You see from time to time, and it doesn't happen nearly enough, you will see maybe a town councilman or somebody in some nondescript low-level office say something that violates the gods of cultural Marxism. Say they say something about traditional marriage or whatever. Of course, the entire media comes down and crushes that person, and they give the obligatory apology. And the support groups of the regime make it out as though they're standing up against the intolerant establishment. But no, you're talking about a single dissident. The establishment is entirely and completely on the side of the left. I mean,
and they're intolerant as hell.
That's right. And by God, are they intolerant. But every Fortune 500 company, every chamber of commerce, they're all in the tank for the LGBTQ plus movement and all of that. I mean, all of the latest interventions of the left, all of media, academia, increasingly the churches, the businesses, et cetera, all of the institutions are for that. You know, so far from fighting the man, these people are the man. But this leads into the question. We have no businesses that are for us, whether it be a grocery store, a shoe store, a financial institution, a school, et cetera. How do we get any businesses to support our people?
Is that to me or to Kevin?
Yeah, that's you first, Guillaume, and then to Kevin.
I think businesses respond to social pressure. People need to look at tech. I think people can get into tech and make identitarian friendly tech companies. People need to start themselves.
I don't know. We're up against a huge problem, as James and the questioner is implying. I mean, the establishment, top to bottom, is on board with this revolution. The big tech companies, all the Fortune 500, the small companies, and it's policed rigorously. And you have something like Tucker Carlson. They put huge pressure on the advertisers. So this is the result of left activism.
I think it will change. As I say this fairly often, there are only a dedicated few on either side of the political spectrum. People like us on our side who are ardent believers in a cause that we find greater than ourselves, and no matter what pressures they will put on us, we will not surrender our integrity or our honor. We're going to stay true to the cause that animates us. Most people just take the path of least resistance. If and when our culture changes back to whatever you want to call it, traditionalism, I'll just call it common sense. When things are corrected, all of these businesses will fall in line. They're just taking the path of least resistance. Most people do that, and they will all be parroting the rhetoric that the head table gives. And if ever we sit at the head table again, all of these people will be right-thinking nationalists.
You can say the same about religion, that they'll fall in line. All the big changes happen after, in religions, how far left religions are, as you personally know all about. That those happened after the counterculture revolution, and they went along with it. It's easier to do that, to stand up and defy these people.
Well, but I'll tell you what, but the eye of Sauron that we live under catches everyone. And a lot of these businesses would be deplatformed or run out of business, in fact, if they dared buck the trend. In fact, you probably know, I know some of our listeners or our viewers probably do. I forget this is YouTube and not radio where I'm accustomed, but there is a farmer's market, I believe in Indiana, a farmer's market. And this small little fruit stand, vegetable stand, donates, I believe, a portion of their proceeds to some nationalist causes. And they have come under all sorts of duress. This is just a fruit stand. So, yes, if any
of this is also the case of Chick-fil-A, where the chairman, I think, is anti-LGBTQ or something. I don't know what it is. Probably know it's very mild kind of stuff. But anyway. His restaurants are being protested. I know there's one in Toronto. University of Kentucky wants to ban them from campus and other places like that. So, yeah, they're up against it. You can see the pressure. And they usually have often succeeded. But Chick-fil-A has become one of the top, I think it's the second most popular fast food chain.
Yeah.
In the
country. Yes.
It's amazing. I was in the Atlanta airport, you could believe the lines at Chick-fil-A too.
who are the customers, Kevin?
Well, they were just, they're white people and they tend to be young.
Yeah, okay. No black people.
Yeah. Chick-fil-A has good food. It is a chain that was founded in the South by fundamentalist Christians, and I don't think they ever really said anything that controversial. The Cathy family, his name was Pruitt Cathy, who founded Chick-fil-A in the Atlanta area. Of course, now it's expanded to this huge juggernaut, but I don't think he ever really said anything. Well, you don't have to. You can offend the delicate sensibilities of the left without doing very much at all. I think basically he just let it be known that he was a Christian, he was going to be closed on Sunday, he believed in the Bible as God's word, et cetera. And of course, in that, there are some condemnations of homosexuality, and that got attached to them. But they themselves have not really done anything to fan that flame. They've just not come out and gone totally in the tank for the homosexual lobby. And that alone apparently is enough. All right, 10 minutes. Let's get to this. Kevin, I know the answer to this because we just talked about it on my radio show on Saturday. But the audience wants to know if you're working on a new book.
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about fried green tomatoes. Anyway,
we're talking about deep fried Oreos.
Okay, deep fried. Oh, no. I still can't believe they exist. Anyway, yes, my book. I want to get it out within a week, man. It is coming along. I'm doing the index. I'm on the S's. And I'm going to put that in there, and we'll see what happens. But I'm very excited about it, yeah. Very excited. It's called Individualism and the Western Liberal Tradition. I'm trying to explain how we became so damn liberal, okay? And some of the good things about it and the bad things about it, but how it developed historically and ethnically and that sort of thing. So it's a big project. Really, it's been something I've been thinking about and working on for the last 40 years. I started publishing in the 1980s on Western marriage and monogamy and that sort of thing, and all that's in the book.
Okay, this is a provocative question. I'll make it YouTube friendly. To you first, Kayum, and then to you, Kevin. Suppose there were a hypothetical group of people who had a disproportionate amount of control over our institutions in this country. If they did not have this control, would whites be more ethnocentric and patriarchal and less degenerate? In other words, does this hypothetical group merely exploit an existing weakness within our people, or do they poison the well?
Well, this is an eternal question. I think we cannot underestimate the degree to which our niceness has become autonomous. We can talk about the historical origins as being tied to Jewish groups. But, I look at, the way a lot of French elites react, like real French elites or Swedish elites or German elites, it's not Jews telling them what to do. They're doing this autonomously. But as a point of historical fact, the spearhead for this kind of thinking, multiculturalism, immigration, Marxism, has tended to be Jewish groups. and in the U.S., because I'm more comfortable talking in stark terms about the U.S. In the U.S., the fact of the matter is that half of the Democratic Party's money comes from Jews. A quarter of the Republican Party's money, including the top guy, Sheldon Adelson, a huge portion of the media, 25% of the Ivy Leagues. I mean, forget about it. Like, all the top economic academics cited the Federal Reserve until recently, three guys in a row, if I'm not mistaken. It just goes on and on. So in Europe, it's more, I would say the picture is more nuanced. But in America, it seems quite plain.
Kevin, I'll repose the question to you. If we had, let's just say, an ethnostate that was purely white European people, would we be more ethnocentric and patriarchal and less degenerate, or have those who oppose our nation states exploited a weakness, or have they actively poisoned the well?
Well, I think if we had an ethnostate, yes, we would be more in the center, because that would mean that we would control the media. And you'd have, you know, talking heads in the media, the newspapers and everything else would be promoting that kind of a message that ethnic identity is good. Being a white person is okay. And white ethnocentrism is okay. I mean, what the big project of the Frankfurt School was to pathologize white ethnocentrism. But I do think, though, that this new elite has taken advantage of Western tendencies. That little section in the last chapter of my book, that the left has exploited Western tendencies towards moral universalism, individualism, that sort of thing, and has taken them to extremes, especially since they came to power in the 1960s. You know, now it's interpreted, until 1965, the immigration law in the United States was biased towards Northwestern Europe. We had a sense that we were a European culture, and we wanted to stay that way. Well, since then, that's not the case. But now you've got this culture of nurturance and individual rights that apply to even people who don't live in this country and would perhaps like to come here. So all this has been perverted, really, but they've taken advantage of the Western liberal tradition, which is essentially why I wrote the book. And so they essentially know our weaknesses, and that is an exploitable weakness. I mean, there's a famous Jewish activist named Israel Zangwill in the early part of the 20th century, and he's talking in opposition, because at that time there was a big movement to restrict immigration. He said, we have to combat them on their own terms. We have to say they're violating Nordic ideals. In other words, basically saying you people have ideals and you have to live up to them. We don't have those ideals, but you do, and so you should live up to them. And that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about, where, you know, our ideals are held against us, and then they're used to essentially replace us.
Guillaume, a final word to you, and then we're going to do a little wrap up.
Well, I don't have much to say, except that people should take care of themselves. They should work out. They should have a spiritual practice. They should, most of them should find a wife and try to be the person that they want the rest of the society to be.
Gentlemen, another 90 minutes gone by far too quickly. Again, we were a little late in getting the September installment up here, but now it is, and it'll be up on our websites. I want to thank Dr. McDonald, of course, my colleague and our guest, Guillaume Durocher, for investing a little bit of time with our audience tonight. If you want to keep the work of these good men going, one last time, toqlive.com/membership. toqlive.com/membership. Subscribe to the Occidental Quarterly Print Journal. You will receive a copy. Somebody will even receive this copy we've used here on the show today. And again, we want to thank Kim Gibbidin for helping us work out our tech quirks. And we wouldn't be here today without him. Give him a subscribe on YouTube, won't you? YouTube.com/DailyKen, DalyKenn, YouTube.com/DailyKen. Kevin, Always a pleasure, my friend. These installments keep getting better and better. A little secret, Kevin books all the guests. So
this is a great show, James, and I sure hope it stays up on YouTube. They've taken a few of them down. But this is part of the censorship environment that we live in. We have to sort of live with it. I'll certainly have it posted on Occidental Observer very quickly, and it will be on my Twitter pinned tweet. So we do the best we can.
We take a licking and we keep on ticking. And it has just been, of course, Kevin, you and I have collaborated for years and years and years, but we're coming up on the 1-year anniversary of the founding of this particular YouTube initiative. And I have enjoyed it as much as I've enjoyed anything I've been involved in. Working with you continues to be a privilege and an honor. So for Kevin McDonald and Guillaume DeRocher, thanks again to Daily Ken and our web team here at TOQLive.com. I'm James Edwards, and we'll see you next month. Goodbye, everybody.
Kevin, thank you, James.